Welcome to the Research Impact Podcast Series. I'm your host, Professor Helena Lenihan, and I chair the University of Limerick's Research Impact Committee. In this episode, we will meet an award-winning research team who are working with government and advocacy groups to support those directly affected by disability. Those caring for those with disability, child carers, and those affected by domestic violence. I'm really delighted to introduce the team from the Centre for Social Issues Research at the University of Limerick. And this team are winners of the President's Research Excellence and Impact Award for Outstanding Research Collaboration. So first of all, just to congratulate you all, well done on this great achievement, which represents both excellence and impact. The Centre has a long history of collaborating to tackle the challenges facing marginalised members of our communities. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the Centre for Social Issues Research advised government in Ireland and the UK on how to best support COVID-19 frontline workers, how to support carers and those living with underlying conditions, as well as how to support adherence to public health advice. I would now like to welcome my esteemed panel of experts. Today with us, we have Professor Orla Muldoon, who's the founding chair of psychology at UL and is a holder of a European Research Council Advanced Award. We also have today Professor Mike Quayle, who's a social psychologist, and he too is a holder of a European Research Council Award as a Starter Grant Award. We also have Dr. Sarah Jay, who's a lecturer in social psychology based here in the Department of Psychology at the University of Limerick. With us here today, we have Professor Stephen Gallagher, who's a health psychologist and a professor of psychology also at the University of Limerick. And finally, with us today, we have Dr. Siobhan Howard, who's a senior lecturer in the Department of Psychology, also here at the University of Limerick. So once again, just to really congratulate all of you on this really well-deserved award. So I might kick off with you, Orla, if that's okay. When we were looking at your submission for the award, we thought it was really interesting that your group has a mantra. And the mantra of your research group is nothing about us without us. Be really interesting to know, as with our listeners, you know, can you explain what you mean by this concept and what it means to all of you?
Thanks, Helena, for the lovely introduction. And indeed, thank you to the panel and the research office for the award. We're really very delighted. It's great validation for us. So in terms of the mantra, I guess what we're trying to get at there is when we look at any social problem, and in particular, intractable social problems, sometimes what people do is they try and figure out the problem without speaking to those who actually are the people affected by the problem. And really, to answer the question properly, you need to understand how it's lived, how it's understood. So the idea of that mantra is that we really pay attention and are driven by the problems that people have or experience and they bring to us. So if we took the COVID crisis as an example, if we want to look at whether or not people can live within the restrictions, we have to understand, you know, if we say something like, you know, we want people to stay at home, we have to understand that staying at home might have costs, or are there particular people who won't be able to stay at home that they might need to go to work. So, you know, to tell them to stay at home means, you know, isn't a sensible instruction. So we need to give them instructions that they make them inclined to stay with what it is. And the only way you can do that is if you have people who are directly affected by the problem informing your work. So we like those affected by issues to drive the research questions that we bring our expertise to bear on. So they're the experts in the problem, we're the experts in the research.
And Orla, just following up on that, it's really interesting, and I think it's something we've all kind of lived through. How do you get people to get involved so that the people who are experiencing it are the experts also? You know, that people looking on like us feel, well, you know, it's not all theoretical, but, you know, they're living through this as well. How do you do that in reality?
once people realise that research has an important role to play and that research can shine a light on an issue that is for them a very serious problem, then people are much more likely to engage. So I again would emphasise that if your research question is driven by the problems that people experience, well, then they're going to engage with you because they want the problem solved. So if we take, like we have worked for a long number of years with Acquired Brain Injury Ireland, and one of the issues that they have is that people with brain injury are often marginalised and pushed out of, you know, occupational roles or maybe mainstream society. If you're willing to look at how it is that people are pushed out and how maybe you can get people pulled back in, of course they're going to engage with you because that's the problem that they think is the key issue. I think sometimes researchers have research questions that aren't the key questions for the groups that they seek to do research with. So, of course, they're not going to engage, but they will engage if you're driven by their concerns.
And I suppose that's why we've lots of talk about citizen engagement and those kind of issues, you know, a lot at the moment. Sarah, I might just turn to you, coming back to that issue of COVID, which Orla spoke about there. So if we look specifically at the collaboration of the group with the Department of Health, can you talk us through the research which has informed the specific issue about health messaging around the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, we know from social psychology that messaging needs to be inclusive and that, you know, national governments have tended to take a very national focus when it comes to the COVID crisis, even though it's a global pandemic. And they've used solidarity as a way to kind of bring everyone along. We're all in this together. However, when there isn't a focus on a diverse solidarity, a diverse national community, minority group members can be kind of left out of that messaging. So we found in our research that it was really important to kind of use really inclusive language. So us, we, our community, and also kind of a diverse kind of image of the national group as well. So kind of, you know, an ethnically mixed group was really important, not necessarily for majority group members. So, you know, more powerful group members in the community, but minority groups, because then their adherence, their reported adherence to the kind of behaviours that would slow the spread of the virus were as high as majority group members. And that kind of led on to a systematic review that we did to look at international published studies on vaccine hesitancy. And we found that it was trust in governments, science and healthcare that was driving people's willingness or lack of willingness to take up the vaccine. So we found again that it was majority group members, high income, men, older people, majority ethnic members who were more likely to report a willingness to take a vaccine, and majority group members, again, less likely to show that willingness or more hesitant because of historical reasons. You know, majority group members are more likely to have been had their trust undermined in the past by the healthcare system. So we suggested that communication really needed to come from the community, trusted members, trusted GPs or people embedded in the communities that could help bring minority group members along in that messaging.
Okay, and can you give us or point to any examples with these minority groups that, you know, you felt worked particularly well because of your research or how your research input into that discussion, just in the kind of a practical sense so that our listeners can get some feel of, you know, who are these minority groups we're talking about?
Well, in Ireland, for instance, you know, members of the travelling community, for example, are a really important minority group who are far, it's much harder for them to adhere to the behaviours that we were being asked to adhere to, you know, living in really overcrowded conditions, for example, with a lack of water to take on the washing that kind of needed to be done, etc. So although we didn't have huge numbers of traveller community in our samples, we did have some. And we found that, you know, a more inclusive message helped to encourage that group to adhere to the behaviours as well. So it wouldn't be through lack of willingness, it'd be through lack of opportunity. So it's systematic kind of causes, that causes differences in behaviours, we've found.
It's very interesting to hear that real practice impact with these minority groups, because we can all read about these in a kind of a theoretical way, but it was really helpful to give those examples. Thank you very much for that, Sarah. Stephen, I might turn to you now. Clearly, your centre has had a long history of partnership with government and with NGOs. And I'm just curious to ask you, have you noticed a change in how evidence is used to inform policy over the years? And related to that then, has the COVID-19 accelerated this?
Yes, Helena, that's a really important question. And it's something that we have seen more and more of. Orla mentioned Acquired Brain Injury Ireland earlier on. Like, there are several others that we would be currently working with and have worked with. Pieta House is another one. People know Pieta House for the suicide prevention kind of stuff. Again, Rape Crisis, Family Carers Ireland, Care Alliance Ireland. These are just, you know, a couple of the NGOs and not-for-profit sectors that we work with. And what we've seen with these are, you know, a lot of their funding comes from charities, so they do a lot of fundraising. And again, sometimes they get funding from government, but they have to apply to government for this funding. They have to justify, you know, this funding by who the advocate for. Are they having an impact on the health and well-being of those? You know, what services they're offering? Is it value for money? So government agencies are looking for, you know, value for money. Who gets the money? Is it prioritised? And all of these kind of things. So these groups are looking for an evidence base behind what they actually do. And this is where we partner with them to try and build a strong evidence base for what they're actually offering for. A good example of this is the Irish Research Council, or the IRC, have this kind of partnership model. It's called New Foundations, where these NGOs can partner with an academic institution to build kind of an evidence base behind the services that might be delivering and so on. And the centre has been really strong in working with these in NGOs for this kind of funding to develop an evidence base behind what they actually do. So it's been a really kind of pivotal and critical work for us, is to do applied research, work that has really good impact. And once we get the evidence base behind these services for these NGOs, they can take this evidence base and legislate for changes in policies, or, you know, to get more funding so they can provide more services for their people who they advocate on our behalf of. And in response to COVID-19, we have seen an increase of this. And a prime example of this is, you know, Care Alliance Ireland provide services and advocacy groups for family carers all over Ireland. And during the COVID pandemic, family carers were severely affected. So they were providing care for people who were sick and disabled and maybe cocooning, if you like. And these were older people cocooning themselves. So they were significantly isolated. Services were all withdrawn because people were actually, you know, seconded to other jobs. So they were isolated and alone without supports. So they had no access. And we know from the work that we do that if you're isolated and alone and don't have supports, you're more likely to suffer mental health consequences. And we've shown this in our own research during COVID of the negative impacts of isolation. So what Family Carers Ireland did was they hopped off the mark and put an online support group together. Now, it was really kind of a strong uptake from family carers. It provided like a resource where they could actually seek information, what was going on, and be with peers among themselves and so forth. But they didn't know how it was working. So we're working with them to develop an evidence base of who this online support group's worth and why is it for. So we're helping Care Alliance Ireland to get an evidence base behind this. And they've recently got funding now from the HSE to keep running this, because COVID is going to be with us for quite a while yet, and there's going to be limited opportunities for face-to-face interactions for family carers. So that's like how COVID would have kind of like changed all of this.
I think for all of us as researchers, you pulled out some really interesting points there about, you know, academia working with different agencies to help them build that evidence base for reasons of accountability, as you said at the beginning, you know, the value for money. Then that helps them to advocate, and then also helps them to maybe do things differently and maybe better in the future. I think it's very interesting, Stephen, the way the speed at which all of this had to happen because of COVID-19. So has your work suggested any kind of preliminary results or insights, or are you at too early a stage yet?
I think we're at too early a stage yet to find, especially for the online support groups kind of stuff. We are at an early stage, but we have evidence to show that caregivers were more severely affected by COVID-19 in terms of the restrictions. So they had higher levels of loneliness, they had higher rates of depression in comparison to those people who do not provide care as well. And we know from international evidence that there has been a significant increase in family carers. So people who might have been working and would have had respite care, for example, now had to take on the full brunt of caring responsibilities. So we know those numbers have actually increased as a consequence of, you know, services being stopped because of COVID. People were seconded and people didn't want to do face-to-face. So we know that from the evidence base.
We'll have to have you back, Stephen, to hear about your results in due course. Now that I have you, so to speak, I'd like to ask you, would you be able to explain to us how the group nature of traumatic experience can help people's resilience?
Yeah, of course, Helene. I suppose there's multiple like traumatic experiences that people can have. You know, like we've worked with people who've experienced earthquakes, for example, you know, where they've lost homes, family members, and all of these kinds of things. If you think about, you know, rape, all of the, like, they're all traumatic events that happen to people, and it challenges all your life's assumptions, where you're going in your life, your ability to form relationships, your all the psychological stuff, your levels of self-esteem. Again, it could be like a life-limiting condition. So you suddenly are healthy and now you have to deal with this illness, HIV, for example. There are, some of these can be very stigmatizing for people. So you might be hidden in the shadows. You might want to hide. But we know when you have a shared those experiences with similar others, people like you who have that same experience, they might have gone through it at different times to you, but they know what that lived experience is like. They have the same kind of like emotional responses, the same kind of life experiences. All of these things are actually important when you talk to others who have that shared experience as you. And you get a sense of trust. If you trust these individuals because they've walked in your shoes, it's completely different when somebody has not that shared experience. You're unlikely to share those raw details that you have might experienced. So when you share the experience with people who have gone through the same trauma as you, you're more likely to trust them. You're more likely to believe them. But also that gives you access to a wider group of people. They can advocate for each other. Once you're in a collective and you have the same experience, it's not just one person, it's two people. Next, suddenly it becomes a group. And that group identity helps with your self-esteem. And we know self-esteem is one of the key factors in promoting resilience. Again, that group will give you access to the social support, whether that's information or emotional support. Again, we know support is a key factor in building resilience. So that's what, when you get people together who have that shared experience, despite being a trauma, and this is what the whole notion of the social cure is, and our work within that is really, really powerful in building resilience within those people who are affected by traumatic events.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this social cure idea that you brought up there. What exactly do you mean by that, Stephen?
The social cure is this notion that when you have group memberships, and this trauma is a really good example of it, when people have that shared sense of identity, it serves as a cure. We see social prescribing. It's the same. Get people involved in groups, and it's the groups. You have a shared identity. So trauma groups would be one. People who have HIV, for example, people who are in, you know, other traumatic events. If they share those experiences, they might get better because they're part of those social groups. That's what the social cure is. So equally, you might prescribe antidepressants. It could equally be as effective. And the study's shown that these social groups have the same kind of effects on negating the effects of, you know, distress, as an antidepressant would be, for example, walking groups. That's what the social prescribing is. But the cornerstone of all of this is this social identity stuff and this social cure.
Thanks, Stephen. Maybe just to bring Orla in on this, obviously, you know, Stephen's been talking about traumatic events. Domestic violence is something that, you know, we've been hearing a lot about for many years, and it's very much in the media at the moment. And I know this is something that your research group has also addressed, Orla. You know, your research group has addressed the area of domestic violence and coercive control, leading to a change in legislation. So, Orla, could you share with us today about this legislative change and how it came about?
I guess I'm going to give you the long answer to your question. So, inherent in how we operate within the centre, we use the ideas from the social cure, in effect, with the idea that the group can give us power, can give us a sense of what we're doing is right. We do a lot of peer assessment of each other's work. We try and build up our PhD students and get them to see the power that they can get from other students. So if you like, we use each other as resources to progress whatever the research agenda is. So in the example of domestic violence, it was a PhD student who was doing the work on domestic violence. When she came to the group, we had been doing work on the impact of various forms of violence, but she was the first person to pick up the idea to run with how, I suppose, connections to others could mitigate the worst effects of domestic violence. And around the same time, the Oireachtas was doing a review of gender-based violence and domestic violence. And she spotted that they were inviting submissions. And we kind of hemmed and hawed about whether or not it was too soon, you know, would we or wouldn't we make a submission to the Oireachtas? Anyway, in the classic sort of groups can big you up, we convinced each other that we had data and why wouldn't we go to the Oireachtas? Because there were very many other people who were, as we, you know, watched the thing unfold, were going to the Oireachtas and they didn't have data. So it seemed to us that we at least had, you know, slightly more evidence than some other people who were making submissions. So we made a written submission, and next thing was we were called in front of the Oireachtas committee. Now, obviously, there were several other groups who were in front of the Oireachtas committee, and it was completely, again, in the spirit of the social cure, it was entirely a collaborative effort, because it wasn't just our submission, it was also the submission from places like Women's Aid, Safe Ireland. You know, it was multiple submissions that eventually that got on the statute books, this idea that coercive control was a problem. Specifically, what our contribution was we demonstrated that psychological abuse was as damaging and often more damaging than physical violence. And that we had that, and it's a very well-cited paper now, we had that paper in our pockets. And I guess the other thing that we had in our pockets was an interview study that we had done with extremely well-intentioned members of the judiciary who often sat and adjudicated on family violence cases. And one of the things that was apparent in their thinking, now this wasn't in their judgments, this was just interviews, but that was apparent in their thinking was that they were still working to notions of sort of what the happy nuclear family was. And because this sort of social norm about what a happy family was, even when they heard and could see that there was a domestic violence element to what was going on, this sort of strong norm to keep families together was actually interfering with the reality that was being presented in front of them. And I think that some of that evidence was quite shocking for some of the people in the Oireachtas, because I'm not sure that they had necessarily thought about how, for instance, psychological abuse could play out for people's health, or indeed how some of the most educated people in the land could be constrained by just everyday thinking, which of course they can, which now that I'm on my rant, I want to finish by saying, and I think one of the things that is equally as important as what Sarah was outlining in terms of minority position and understanding the position of minorities, one of the most under-researched groups, a group in our society, are power holders, majority group members who hold power. And in fact, it is really important to understand how people who have power and make decisions, it's really important to understand their thinking if we're to make any progress on issues like gender-based violence.
Thanks, Orla. One of the big elements of your submission for the Excellence and Impact Award, the Collaborative Award, was this notion of excellent research underpinning the kind of practice and policy examples that you give us. And you mentioned there a well-cited paper. I'm just wondering, could you give us the title or where it's published if our listeners are interested in maybe reading a little bit more?
Yeah, I think it's published in the Journal of Interpersonal Relations, and it's called Evidence of Distinct Dimensions of Domestic Violence, something like that. But all of the papers that the group publish would be available through the UL repository. The other thing I would say about that, Helena, is that often people who are involved in practice research don't understand that actually peer-reviewed publications and high-value publications are a real currency. So when you go to places like the Oireachtas and you can demonstrate that actually you have a high-value publication that has been peer-reviewed, that actually it's a really important currency. And I think non-governmental organizations have come to understand that there is value in evidence that is of that high standard. And that's something that all of the group, from PhD student upwards, and it was a PhD student who brought this idea through. So all of the group understand the importance of that.
That's a great message. And I think then there's a body of work for us as academics to communicate, you know, that this is a really good publication, why it is, about the peer review, and then for us to go that step further to, you know, get out the message in an easy digestible way. You know, messaging was something that Sarah and I spoke about earlier on, but I think we have a role to play in that regard as well. Thanks for that, Orla. Because it's so topical, you know, I'd like to return to this. And because your work has had a major influence with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic, I'd like to return to a couple of questions around this. And Mike, I might turn to you at this point. With COVID-19 still really prevalent in our communities, I mean, we hear about it all the time. How do you ensure that stay-at-home workers are aware of how to notice signs of domestic violence? And what can they really do about it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and a really important one, because COVID-19 has sent a lot of public life into private spaces. And our approach really would be to turn that question around a little bit and to say that the person being abused is definitely the most likely to know about it. So who should we really be asking this question of, about like, how do you make them aware of domestic violence? Well, it's probably the person doing the abuse that they need to be made aware of the fact that they're being abusive. It's neighbors, it's bosses, it's guardie, it's politicians. So we really take seriously the feminist ideal that the personal is political, that what happens in private space is not a private thing. It's those things that actually shape society and shape the experiences of people in society, especially vulnerable people. So our approach would be to say that domestic violence is really a symptom of much broader social issues. And that raises questions like, why won't the guardie pick up their phones? Why won't they knock on the door when they get a complaint about domestic abuse? Well, it's because they think that the home is a private space and they don't have any power to do anything in the home. Why do judges call it ordinary, decent domestic violence? So one of our members, Catherine Norton, worked with Orla, interviewed judges and found that judges generally have a sense that a certain level of domestic violence is kind of a normal and healthy thing in society. Well, why do judges think that? Why don't men attack their bosses instead of their wives and children? So all of those things together make us realize that domestic violence is really an issue of power. And it's about imposing power in a space where certain people have a lot of it and others have much less. So that's sort of expressed in a whole lot of different ways. Like one of our PhD students did some work on domestic labor in Irish children. So who does the domestic labor? Who's expected to do it? And she found that across Ireland, the gender difference in domestic labor starts really young. So girl children are expected to do more of it than boy children. And so we're training girls in Irish society to do the grunt work, to look after boys. We're training boys to put their feet up. And of course, that's an expression of power. Who gets to put their feet up and watch TV or play computer games or go out and play sport? That's an expression of basic power in personal space. And the student is Kiva O'Reilly. She's currently doing a PhD with my group, funded by the ERC. And that work has been published in a peer-reviewed journal, which is a substantial achievement for a master's level research project. And, you know, just to wrap that up, domestic violence is really about power. So solving domestic violence is about reshaping society so that women and men have equal power in the home as they should have in broader society. And I think generally we focus a lot on like creating equality in the workplace or in politics. What we really need to do to solve domestic violence is create equality in the home.
You know, as we listen to you today, a big theme throughout your research has been this notion of power, who has the power, groups having power, how they use that power. So we're getting towards the end of this podcast now, so I'd like to finish with maybe some more general questions. If I turn to you, Siobhan, just sticking with COVID-19, I think as researchers, we've all been impacted by COVID-19 in various ways. I know myself, not having data access for about 11 months from the Central Statistics Office was a big issue. They were really helpful in trying to get that data back. But they're the realities, you know, when we're all having to work from home, which has been one of the themes here today. Just wondering, Siobhan, how has the research of this group and your research been impacted by COVID-19?
I think, you know, you've actually touched on things there in that it's the research is impacted in very direct ways, but also indirect ways through the people that actually do the research. So as you said, you yourself had difficulty accessing data for over 11 months. I mean, that was exactly the case within our group. You know, we had PhD students, postdoctoral researchers that got up on the 12th of March, engaged in data collection that day, and by 5 o'clock that evening, were not to return to that lab, and in some cases are still not back in primary data collection. So that has a really immediate and negative impact, I guess, on people's research programmes, on the questions we want to answer. So as I said, it is a negative, but also the positives arose from that, because of course we've heard talk a number of times about the excellent research that's been done by our PhD students. And these PhD students are on programmes of research that have end dates. And so overnight we had these PhD students who could not meet their goals. So we had to come up with ways and pivot our research directions to answer the questions as part of their PhD theses. And so the positives that arose from that was identifying perhaps existing data sets to answer those questions or alternative ways to go about getting to the conclusion and getting the answers that we need. So that's a real direct effect that had both negative and, I suppose, positive outcomes. Indirectly then, look, there's no one that has been unaffected by COVID-19, by lockdowns. You know, Stephen talked about those people who are in caregiving roles, who had supports whipped away from them overnight for a really extended period of time. And that's true for the people that work in our group as well. I mean, even just today at very short notice, one of our panel members had to withdraw because that person's childcare was removed because the childminder had developed COVID. And so you're not just dealing with immediate illness that removes you from your work or really makes you have to prioritize the immediate things. And so your progress in your research program is stalled a little bit. But even still, we're working with structured childcare settings that are on reduced working hours. People are isolating for 10 days, 7 days with their caregiving roles still present or actually ramped up. So even supports that have come back in. So I think those indirect effects has really stalled at times, and really is really stressful to deal with, isn't it? That you're trying to deal with all of these competing demands and you still really want to reach your research goals and get these answers. And then that trickles downward to the people who's the answers to this research affects. And we've heard so many examples of the real world impact the research that emanates from the centre has. So that to me summarises both the direct and the indirect impact. And I suppose largely I would say negative, but there's glimmers of light in terms of how we've been really good, really excellent at pivoting and identifying new ways and alternative ways to answer the questions we want to answer.
Thanks for sharing those insights, Siobhan. I thought it was really interesting the way you talk. I think a lot of us talk about direct effects. You know, obviously, you know, you spoke about students finishing projects and there's obviously funding implications there as well. But the way you distinguish between direct and indirect and how they interact with each other, I think is really interesting. Ora, I might return to you again. You know, we all talk about how our research fits with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And we've heard a diverse but still very together and holistic view of research today. And I think I would imagine that the research of this group fits in under a lot of those sustainable development goals, or maybe it does, or maybe it doesn't in different ways. Maybe, you know, to go back to Siobhan, some of them are direct, some of them are indirect. Could you maybe talk to us a little bit about that, please?
I suppose it isn't surprising to hear that we are very much invested in the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And I suppose a key one would be the final Sustainable Development Goal, which orients to partnerships, because we always hope that we are doing socially relevant and valued research that lies at the very heart of the centre's work. And then if we look at the other sustainable development goals, I guess an overarching concept that I would use and others would use is the idea of positive peace. So one of the UN SDGs is around peace and conflict. So we kind of term peace as in relation to conflict. But actually, more recently in the social sciences and conflict studies in particular, there is this idea of positive peace, that there is a society that we can create that opposes structures that facilitate violence, direct violence and indirect violence, or subordination and prejudice. So it's the idea that we try and resist cultures that support the poor treatment of people based on individual, group, community, ethnic, race, racial memberships. So when you start thinking about positive peace, you start thinking about issues like strong government, strong policy, gender equity, sustainable education, sustainable development, education for peace, good community relations. So actually, it starts drifting across many of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So perhaps when the centre was founded, which was 2009, if I hadn't been so absorbed with CSI at the time, which was one of my favourite TV shows, and we were trying to get CSI into the title of the centre, perhaps if it was to be inaugurated now, we might use the UN SDGs as, you know, the hook on which to hang our activities. But I guess we'll be forever tied up with crime scene investigation, the original.
Thanks for that, Orla. I think another big theme in this chat we're having today is the way you look at things from different perspectives. And I think that's really what makes some research that you do really interesting. So thanks for that. And the bit of humor doesn't go astray either. So that's always nice. We're about to wrap up. So Mike, I might return to you for this question. Clearly, you've been doing a phenomenal amount of research. And I think for us, when we looked at this award, it was a really prime example of excellent research with impact, and impactful research underpinned by excellent research. And that connection was really, really clear to us. So I think what we're all dying to know now is, where are you going to go from here with the research? And what are your maybe some future areas of your research that you'd like to share with us? I think Stephen has pointed to some earlier on, but maybe Mike, you'd like to finish with an answer to that question, please.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that some others will jump in and help me out here. But I think that what unites the group is the realization that social identity is at the heart of a whole lot of really important social issues. Who do we think we are? And who do we think is the same as us or different to us? And we've found through our research so far that that is critical for health, for democracy, for climate change, for vaccine hesitancy. And we're trying to work from the micro to the macro and understand the basic scientific principles of social identity, and then to link it to larger social processes and to practice and ultimately to impact. So some of the work that I'm doing at the moment with my group is trying to develop network models of how social groups are sewn together with threads constituted by shared opinions. So when we share an opinion, we get an affinity for each other. And when we share a bunch of opinions, we start to feel like a group. And of course, that's really important when we think about social media, where the main thing that we see about other people on social media is what do they agree with and disagree with. So that research is going to provide a framework for understanding how social opinions bind people together in groups on through social media, and how does that impact these pressing social issues like climate change? How do we come to agreement on what should we do? When should we do it? How strongly should we act? We've got a strong feeling that a lot of that hinges on these social identity processes. But of course, all his work on social identity and trauma, you know, does anyone want to jump in here and talk?
One of the things that I would like to say that I see developing in the future, and we've started to a degree, is the connection between the sort of groups and social identity and the more physiological metrics around health. So it has been great to have people like Siobhan and Stephen on board, because that sort of stretches us into working in areas where maybe we have paid a lot of attention to the social substrate, whereas our colleagues are forcing us to think about how all of these social concerns are linked to biological indices of health. So to me, that is a big move and an important move. And there's very few groups globally that are attempting to make the connection between social substrate and physiological indices of health. And I leave the experts on that to tell you more.
I think, though, that actually just speaks to a wider thing about why this group has had such impact, in that it has widened and expanded its group membership and its research area focus. And what you have is this collaborative environment where people challenge each other's perspectives and sort of research areas. And that's both challenging, but it's also pushes each other. And this is a two-way street, in that it pushes each other to come at things from a very different perspective, and to try and, you know, if sometimes maybe get two ends to meet, because sometimes you can feel like you're very far apart from the other person's perspective within the centre, but then actually through the dialogue and through these sort of formal structures that are in place within the centre for these collaborative meetings, but also the informal ones, which are unfortunately fewer between with the lack of the coffees, so that you end up driving forward a research agenda and finding, as I said, new ways of addressing the research questions and just really making actually massive leaps forward. I mean, to me, that really is why the centre is so successful in the impact that it has had within the academic community, but as we saw throughout this entire podcast, the far-reaching implications of the research that has arisen from the group.
Sarah, would you like to come in here?
Yeah, I'd love to. So the centre has just been brilliant for this kind of collaborative space. It's a space that we all really thoroughly appreciate, because we can support each other, you know, at a real macro level, where we kind of look at each other's work and critique and talk about research projects. But we also kind of have similar interests in kind of the direction that we want to go in. So Ola was talking there, and Siobhan helped about around kind of that drive towards kind of looking at the biological processes that are related to the more social. And then there's others of us who are really interested in things like structural inequality and how that is impacting, having a massive impact on all sorts of things. You know, the more unequal societies are, the less trust there is, the less kind of hope, cohesion, the more people kind of are driven to supporting kind of strong leaders, desperate for strong leaders to kind of give them some sense of direction. So, yeah, I mean, you know, how kind of group memberships are empowering as well and important for education. I just think, you know, we've got so much in us and so many different directions that we're going to go down in the future. It's watch this space.
I might leave the last word to you on this one, Stephen. As you look to the future, what do you see for the centre and your group?
Yeah, I just want to pick up on what Orla was saying about looking at kind of biological processes. This is something that we've been working on, Siobhan and I, is looking at really how these stress or social factors get inside the body. We know that they're associated with health outcomes like depression, reduced kind of morbidity, mortality, cardiovascular disease. But sometimes one of the weaknesses of earlier studies around self-report is that, you know, it's very subjective. These are hard biological outcomes, so looking at blood pressure, immune responses. So by looking at these, we can actually strengthen the evidence base behind the social cure, for example, of how it gets inside the body, looking at the processes, looking at, so our recent work, for example, we've shown that group membership actually increases support, higher social networks, and that was associated with allostatic load. Allostatic load is this kind of cumulative index of your immune functioning, cardiovascular functioning, as well as hormonal function. So the more groups that were involved in led to higher support and a reduced physiological burden, if you like, which was associated with better health. So that's a really powerful showing way, like, of how these social factors get into the body to improve our health. And Sarah talked about trust, you know, when public health messages is in the Dem or Us situation, public trust is actually diminished. We have recently written a paper that is submitted for publication showing that this lack of trust in and around us has damaging effect for the antibody response to a COVID vaccination. It's really powerful. So people who had this low trust were 38% likely not to have protective levels following a vaccination. So it isn't published yet, but it's actually submitted. So we're hoping to have this. So this is just really powerful to show that our psychology has consequences for our biology, but also our health.
Really interesting, and good luck with that publication. Hopefully we will see it soon. So colleagues, thanks very much for sharing all your insights. It's been a great discussion, and I for one have really enjoyed it. You've been listening to Professor Orla Muldoon, Professor Mike Quayle, Dr. Sarah Jay, Professor Stephen Gallagher, and Dr. Siobhan Howard, who are all part of the Centre for Social Issues Research here at the University of Limerick. And together, they are recipients of the President's Research Excellent and Impact Outstanding Research Collaboration. I would again like to thank you so much for your time today, and congratulations to all of you again on your award. If you would like to hear more about research impact at the University of Limerick, please go to our website, ul.ie/research-impact. The research discussed today has benefited from funding from a range of sources. These include the European Research Council, the Health Research Board, the Irish Research Council, Science Foundation Ireland, and the Carolan Research Trust. Thank you very much for listening.